velocity were miscalculated by just 0.05%, the warhead could miss its target by about 20 miles. The accuracy of a Titan II launch would be determined early in the flight. The sequence of events left no room for error. 59 seconds after the commander and the deputy commander turned their keys, the Titan II would rise from the silo, slowly at first, almost pausing for a moment above the open door, before shooting upward, trailed by flames. About 2.5 minutes after liftoff, at an altitude of roughly 47 miles, the thrust chamber pressure switch would sense that most of the oxidizer in the Stage 1 tank had been used. It would shut off the main engine, fire the staging nuts, send Stage 1 of the missile plummeting to Earth, and ignite the Stage 2 engine. About 3 minutes later, at an altitude of roughly 217 miles, the guidance system would detect that the missile had reached the correct velocity. The computer would shut off the Stage 2 engine and fire small vernier engines to make any last-minute changes in speed or direction. The vernier engines would fire for about 15 seconds, and then the computer would blow the nozzles off them and detonate an explosive squib to free the nose cone from Stage 2. The nose cone, holding the warhead, would continue to rise into the sky as the rest of the missile drifted away. About 14 minutes later, the nose cone would reach its apogee, its maximum height, about 800 miles above the Earth. Then it would start to fall, rapidly gaining speed. It would fall for another 16 minutes. It would reach a velocity of about 23,000 feet per second, faster than a speeding bullet, a lot faster, as much as 10 to 20 times faster. And if everything had occurred in the right order, at the right time, precisely, the warhead would detonate within a mile of its target. In addition to creating an accurate guidance system, missile designers had to make sure that a warhead wouldn't incinerate as it re-entered the atmosphere. The friction created by a falling body of that size, at those speeds, would produce surface temperatures of about 15,000 degrees Fahrenheit, hotter than the melting point of any metal. In early versions of the Atlas missile, the nose cone, also called the re-entry vehicle, RV, contained a large block of copper that served as a heat sink. The copper absorbed heat and kept it away from the warhead, but the copper also added a lot of weight to the missile. The Titan II employed a different technique. A thick coating of plastic was added to the nose cone, and during re-entry, layers of the plastic ablated. They charred, melted, vaporized, and absorbed some of the heat. The cloud of gases released by ablation became a buffer in front of the nose cone, a form of insulation, reducing its temperature even further. In addition to protecting the warhead from heat, the nose cone also housed the weapon's arming and fusing system. On the way up, a barometric switch closed when it reached a specific altitude, allowing electricity to flow from the thermal batteries to the warhead. On the way down, an accelerometer ignited the thermal batteries and armed the warhead. If the warhead had been set for an airburst, it exploded at an altitude of 14,000 feet when a barometric switch closed. If the warhead had been set for a groundburst, or if for some reason the barometric switch malfunctioned, it exploded when the piezoelectric crystals in the nose cone were crushed upon impact with the target. Instead of being vaporized by re-entry, the warhead was kept cool and intact long enough to vaporize everything from miles around it. Three strategic missile wings were formed to deploy the Titan II, each with 18 missiles, located in Arkansas, Kansas, and Arizona. The Air Force felt confident that the Titan II would be more reliable than its predecessors. At first, perhaps 70 to 75% of the missiles were expected to hit their targets, and as crews gained experience, that proportion would rise to 90%. Newspapers across the country heralded the arrival of the Titan II, America's superweapon, the biggest guns in the Western world. The missile would play a dual patriotic role in the rivalry with the Soviet Union. It would carry SAC's deadliest warhead. and also serve, in a slightly modified form, as the launch vehicle to send NASA's Gemini astronauts into space. At Little Rock Air Force Base, the introduction of the Titan II was greeted with a nervous enthusiasm. The first launch crews had to train with cardboard mock-ups of equipment, and the number of operational launch complexes in Arkansas soon exceeded the number of crews qualified to run them. Vital checklists were still being written and revised as the missiles were placed on alert. Ben Scalorn became a site maintenance officer for the 308th Strategic Missile Wing, eventually overseeing half a dozen Titan II launch complexes. He liked the new job and didn't hesitate to wear a Refco and work long hours beside his men. Launch Complex 373-4 in Searcy was one of his sites. After the fire killed 53 workers there, he was part of the team that pulled the missile from the silo. It was a sobering experience. Thick black soot covered almost everything, but handprints could still be seen on the rungs of ladders, and the bodies of fallen workers had left clear outlines on the floor. Scalorn could make out the shapes of their arms and legs, the positions of their bodies as they died, surrounded by black soot. All that remained of them were these pale, ghostly silhouettes. Jeff Kennedy was furious. They were just sitting there in the dark at the end of the access road with their thumbs up their asses, doing nothing while the missile got ready to blow. Colonel Morris said they'd been ordered to wait for further instructions, period. The decisions were being made elsewhere, and nothing was to be done without the approval of SAC headquarters. Morris hadn't shared Kennedy's latest plan with the command post, and nobody had asked to hear it. In fact, none of the PTS guys or launch crew members on the scene had been asked to give an opinion of what should be done. Kennedy thought that was bullshit. They were there. They were ready to go. They had all the knowledge and experience you needed. What were they waiting for? Every minute they waited to do the job would make the job more dangerous. At about 10:15, almost 4 hours after the accident, the Disaster Response Force arrived. But its commander, Colonel William Jones, had no authority at the site. A disaster hadn't occurred yet. The five vehicles in his convoy pulled off Highway 65 and parked along the access road. Members of his team got out of their trucks, introduced themselves, and distributed sea rations and canned